This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, it is not cyclical. It is happening. And, you know, you could stop emitting carbon into the atmosphere now, all over the world. And it would take hundreds of years for our planet to revert back to the temperatures that we had in the late 19th century before we started putting so much carbon in the air.
Hurricane Sandy highlighted the devastating effects of a changing climate and rising sea levels like perhaps no other event we've seen in this country. Will the silver lining of Sandy's thousand-mile-wide storm cloud be widespread recognition of the tangible and imminent dangers of climate change? This week on Sea Change Radio, I speak with Neela Banerjee, the energy and environment reporter for the Los Angeles Times, to discuss the impact of Sandy, not on the subways of New York or the Jersey Shore, but on the media's handling of climate change and in political discourse beyond the election. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Neela Banerjee. She's an environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Neela, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
You have a very interesting article in today's Los Angeles Times called Sandy, A Galvanizing Moment for Climate Change. The fallout of Sandy has been that climate change has been highlighted a little bit more than it was from previous disasters like Hurricane Katrina. Do you think that this is governmental failure was highlighted more in Katrina, or do you think on the flip side it's because the government handled it better this time and then it was also, let's say, it was New York City, or do you think this was really just in a vacuum more of a tipping point in terms of climate change awareness?
I think it's probably the last option. Katrina was 7 years ago, and research into the effect of climate change on hurricanes is still not great because it's relatively new, but it was obviously 7 years ago, it was even worse. Now, climate scientists are still trying to figure out how climate change is influencing hurricanes, their strength, their size, their frequency. Some of the best data are in the North Atlantic. But what you'll hear in a broad sense is that because the planet is getting hotter, there's more water vapor in the air, and that could lead to, and it is leading to, greater rainfall. And scientists predict that by the end of the century, we will have 20% more rainfall in these events than we do now. So you know, people are the science is converging around this and clarifying the picture some. But I also think one of the things that's happening purely on the ground level among regular people is that they're starting to feel the effects of climate change. I think for a lot of us, climate change seemed to be something that was going to happen in the distant future. And there have been, and for better or for worse, people look at the weather as an indication of what is happening in the climate. And for a long time, scientists said you shouldn't do that. And no one weather event can be attributed to climate change. But now there's more science coming out that backs that kind of popular response. That in fact, you do see the influence, the fingerprints of climate on weather events. So people have been through a mild winter. Most of the country has been in low rainfall or drought conditions, everything from low rainfall to severe drought. And now you have a late season hurricane hitting a part of the country that's not used to hurricanes. So all of these are converging to change people's minds about climate change. And there are polls that show that. One of the best polls on public opinion comes out of Yale University and George Mason University, and that poll in September 2012 shows that a greater percentage of Americans accept the science on climate change and accept the science that human beings are behind it than they have since late 2008, which was sort of the high point of this.
Do you have the numbers on both of those by any chance offhand? I'm curious about the latter and whether human beings are behind it. Like how, because that seems to be the new talking point. It's like, yes, climate change is real, but we just don't know who's causing it. So I'm curious how effective that messaging has been in terms of seeping into the mainstream.
So it's a bit more than half, right? I think it's something like 54%. But here's the interesting thing. So more than half believe that climate change is caused by human activity, according to the Yale Project on Climate Change Communications September 2012 poll. And 58% say they are somewhat or very worried about it. And apparently, with both those indicators, those are the highest levels of belief in human-caused climate change and concern about it. Those are the highest levels since late 2008, according to the Yale Project.
And Sandy and Irene were about, I think, 14 months apart and both hitting New York City. You had mentioned how this is not going to be so unusual at the end of this century, but how unexpected was a storm of Sandy's magnitude?
So it's interesting that we're talking now. I was just chatting with a colleague of mine, Brian Bennett, who covers Homeland Security and FEMA is in his purview, and he just got back from New York. And he was saying that, first of all, getting to the point of this discussion, people on the ground are saying, this is what the new normal is going to be. This is our new reality. You know, welcome to the rest of our lives, right? They really are seeing this as the outcome of climate change. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that a lot of people, you know, are stuck in communities with no power, and because Irene didn't hit them as bad as this one. I think that that's one of the issues here is that, and I grew up in Louisiana, which is very prone to hurricanes, and you see this, that if people go through a hurricane or two and the warnings seem to be overstated to them, they just feel like any kind of warning is hype, and they don't take it seriously. So I think the convergence here is that a lot of people were complacent about this or discounted the warnings. They thought it was hype, so they stayed in place. And then you really had, you know, and the warnings turned out to be right. It was a 100-year storm, and it battered them very badly. So now they're feeling it on their own skin in a way they didn't with Irene.
Do you think that the language may start changing as well in terms of 100-year storm or a perfect storm, these things that are going to be more frequent, but do you think we use them to alert citizenry to evacuate? If you were the governor saying, this is a 100-year storm, get out. You know, you could understand like that 100-year storm has impact still with people, but do you think 20, 30 years from now, we may not be saying that?
I don't know. I mean, I think what people might do is refer to storms that are recent in the collective memory. So maybe you don't need to say 100-year storm if people remember Katrina and Sandy, right? All of a sudden, women's names are very evocative of the damage that could be done to you. So,
That's right.
That, you know, you could...
Well, Sandy could be a man.
Well, Sandy could be a man, too. That's right. I know some Sandys who are men. So I just keep, you know, thinking of, like, Sandy Dennis or something like that. But anyway, the point is that what could happen is that for example, if a storm like this were bearing down on North Carolina, right? You know, the governor and the authorities in North Carolina could say, this is going to hit us like Sandy hit New York, like Katrina hit Louisiana, and people will get it. People, you know, so you don't need to say 100-year storm anymore. Sadly, you will have these points of reference and you will have these images that are seared in people's memories. And I think in many ways, Sandy goes even further than Katrina did, not just because, you know, like I said, the science was less sure during Katrina, but because, you know, Katrina's in a part of the country where people get beat up by hurricanes all the time. So for Sandy to create these kinds of landscapes and these kinds of tensions and this kind of deprivation in a place, in a rich, populated, you know, Northeast, right? Who thinks of hurricanes in the Northeast? I think that's going to sink in a way that Katrina didn't into the popular consciousness.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Neela Banerjee. She's the environment and energy reporter out of the Washington Bureau for the Los Angeles Times. Neela, do you think that Hurricane Sandy made the absence of climate change in the national media and dialogue in general more conspicuous?
I don't think it made it more conspicuous as such. I mean, I think to those of us who cover this, I mean, we all of a sudden we notice that, oh, look, you know, people are talking about this, but I think the average American has been focused a lot on day-to-day pocketbook issues and not really been thinking about this stuff until now. And I think the convergence of all of these extreme weather events and the fact that gradually the economy is coming out of the doldrums, so the pressure is easing up on people here and there, and they can think about bigger issues. I think those things are certainly working on popular consciousness. You know, the media, I hate to say it, I mean, we're so ADD, like we're going to chase, I guarantee you by next week, most of the mainstream media, especially what people follow on cable news, will not be on this. But the regular person on the street, you know, next time a storm comes in or there's a drought declaration, they're going to be thinking about this.
Let's dig deeper into the journalism side of this. The lines between what goes on the front page of the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times and the environmental sections are now becoming a little more blurred. I'm just wondering how climate change becomes more of a crossover political issue rather than just relegated to a particular section of a newspaper.
Right. So I think that the New York Times, the LA Times, Washington Post, we're not very good indicators of this because we actually do write about climate change, about sea level rise, about all sorts of environmental issues when there aren't big storms. But we are not what most people turn to get their news. I mean, CNN, Fox News, so it's got to be there. And Fox, you know, which has a huge audience, is in absolute denial of climate change and mocks it. So, you know, a lot of Americans aren't getting information there. As you know, the effect of the media in changing the political discourse, I don't think it's really going to come from us. I think where it's going to come from are several places. One is that you're going to have Republicans in places like the Northeast or California who are going to be in a tough place if they don't speak out on climate change. I think, you know, those states are blue enough that those Republicans will have to move to the center and not vote on climate and environmental issues like their colleagues from coal states. I think that's the first thing. And then the other thing is that people will start looking at candidates in various races and see where they stand on climate. I mean, I don't think climate is going to become a litmus test issue anytime soon, but I think it'll have more weight than it has had in the decision-making of the electorate than in previous years.
I read an interesting article that said that early in the Obama administration, they decided that climate change was not a political winner, that they were just not going to make this one of their selling points. If you've been watching the campaign as obsessively as I have, and I assume you have, you see when the candidates, both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, go into their memorized list of all the good things they do, climate change never comes up. We have to attribute that somewhat to the media. And obviously, you and I, we're all part of this media, so it's a very amorphous finger I'm pointing. But not having it come up in the presidential debates, the rest of the world looks at this and must want to tear their hair out. It's pretty frustrating when there are other industrialized nations that have taken bold steps to try to fight this inexorable slide into seas rising, etc.
Obama, when he took office, didn't talk about climate change after his soaring rhetoric on the trail, you know, once he actually took office, didn't talk about climate change the way he talked about the economy or healthcare. And I think part of it is that he, he was presented with this very grave economic crisis, and that's where he was expending his political capital. And I think, he saw healthcare, tackling that as a way of avoiding another economic crisis down the line. Cap and trade was not loved by the Republicans, but there were a lot of people on the left who didn't love it either. And the person who was supposed to take it through Congress was Rahm Emanuel, and I don't get a sense that he loved it very much either. All of that said, Obama actually has taken steps through his executive powers, through the EPA, in the wake of the failure of cap and trade, to severely curtail American carbon emissions. So the fuel economy standards that his administration has put forward and that the auto industry has agreed to will be probably what some environmentalists say is the single biggest step any country has taken to reduce carbon emissions, right? Then things that the EPA is doing to that will affect coal-fired power plants and oil refineries, their emissions will also have the effect of cutting back carbon emissions. So he's done a lot of stuff pretty quietly. I mean, we write about it, the Post, the major papers write about it, but it's not like it's going to be on the evening news, right? But so the interesting thing, though, is that you're right. He doesn't talk about this on the stump. And when he has talked about climate change, it's been to specific audiences, usually young audiences, college students and the like. Because I think, politicians by their very nature are timid creatures. They're not bold and they're following public opinion. And I think until this year, Obama and his team were seeing climate change as an issue that wasn't really going to win them a lot of points. I mean, their base that accepts the science of climate change, it's not like those folks are going to go vote for Romney. And so I think they felt like if they said anything on this or they campaigned on this, it would just tilt things in Romney's favor in a very tight race. So I think they played it very, very cautiously. They were looking at the public opinion data about climate change. But that data, as we were discussing earlier, has shifted significantly this year. He's still not talking about it a lot, but if he does win, we'll see what will happen in a second term. And what I've heard from people here in D.C. is that if Obama wins, that he would find a way to deal with climate on a more comprehensive basis. Now, that said, all the things he's already done and his EPA has done are going to continue, and they'll probably build on that again through the executive, right, through the administration, not through legislation. What he could do is probably not cap and trade. Like I said, I think cap and trade is not something they're going to come back to, and there are good reasons why neither side, neither Republicans nor Democrats, like cap and trade. But there might be something like a carbon tax, and especially if you have this big deficit, it's a way to bring in revenue. Now, you have to make sure that it doesn't hit the poorest hard, but that could be something that you could see late in a second Obama term. And there are Republicans who accept the science on climate change. Bob Inglis, who's from South Carolina, who was voted out of office because of he ran against a Tea Party member in 2010. He's now at a think tank in D.C., and he has hope that if Romney wins, that Romney may be in a better position than Obama to strike a deal with Tea Party members over action on climate change. The problem is, we're not hearing any indication from Romney that he would actually want to do that. And the Tea Party members, may say no dice. So no, but in a Romney presidency, there's some people who believe that he would be in a better position to deal with this than Obama was.
Nothing is lonely To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the energy and environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Neela Banerjee. Neela, I heard an interesting quote from Chris Hayes on his MSNBC show this weekend, and it said, "You're either on the side of your fellow citizens and residents of this planet, or you're on the side of the storms as yet unnamed. You cannot be neutral. So which side are you on?" So from a journalist perspective like yourself, how do you deal with this neutrality question as climate change continues to be this divisive issue? Is a journalist's duty always to just remain neutral, or are there, you know, are there always two sides to everything? Where do you stand when it comes to this?
So the first thing, I mean, I would take issue with what Chris Hayes said, because I don't think it's fair to say that people who don't accept the science on climate change are somehow against their fellow citizens. I think a lot of them would argue that, in fact, the solutions to dealing with climate change are so severe that it would hurt everybody, that it would hurt their fellow citizens, and therefore they shouldn't do it. And I think that is a lot of where the resistance comes from. People look at the solutions. Folks who are right of center see, or not just right of center, but quite conservative, see this as a radical wealth distribution program that could be very damaging to the American economy, and they don't want to take that tack. And from there, they back into their rejection of the science. So it's not, you know, it comes from the sense of where is the common good, and what are the solutions to the common good. So that's where I would take issue with Chris Hayes. On the broader question of the science and the sense of two sides, I mean, I think most major media that doesn't have a conservative point of view, so I'm talking about mainstream media that tries to play it up the middle, and more sort of progressive media like Huffington Post and others that have a political slant, they don't do what we used to call a false equivalency, right? We don't say that the science is controversial. We are very clear to say that the vast majority of scientists accept the idea that human beings, accept the research, you know, that, excuse me, that human beings are, that human activity is the main driver of climate change. And we don't say that it is scientifically controversial at all, because it is not scientifically controversial. It is politically controversial. And that is why we write about this. And that is why, you know, sometimes we have people in our stories who are skeptical of climate change, because those who do not accept climate change continue to be a very powerful political force. I mean, you know, the Republican candidate is in that position. I mean, the Republican Party, you know, is in that position. So in that sense, that is why journalists are writing about it. But it's not because we think the science is controversial. I mean, I personally don't, and I write my stories in a way that says that. I mean, that not in a way. It's that my stories say that explicitly, and I you know, catch a lot of flack from readers who reject climate change.
I heard Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, saying we can have a debate about whether humans are causing climate change, but the effects of climate change are really not debatable. I'm paraphrasing here, but
yes.
Do you think that's an effective tactic to try to draw in those who don't believe in climate change, or that humans are causing climate change, just throwing out an olive branch to them, saying, okay, we can have an argument about this, but we have some real problems here? To me, it seemed like it was like we have to tackle the short-term solutions as soon as possible, like trying to build better levees in New Orleans and trying to ensure that our cities like New York are not going to be devastated by flooding. But in terms of the longer term policies that also would go hand in hand with believing that human beings are causing this climate change, that would be maybe a little more politically unpalatable. That was kind of my takeaway from that. What's your reaction when you hear that?
I think that's a really good question. And I think there are, I see what he's trying to do. And we have seen, I did a story earlier in the summer about how people in the South don't really want to talk about climate change. A lot of them don't accept it, but they're seeing a greater number of deaths amongst high school football players because of a couple of trends that are proving really lethal. One is an increased obesity amongst high school football players, and the other is hotter summers, right? So without addressing climate change, like why this is happening, several southern states, including Georgia and Arkansas, have instituted very, very good rules to govern practices for high school football players to cut down or eliminate these deaths among high school football players. So getting back to Cuomo's point, I mean, you can get people to act and take sensible steps without getting into this whole debate about climate change. I mean, I see what he's trying to do, and I think you can do it in some places. The problem here with sea level rise and preparing for storm surges is that, you know, if you don't accept climate change, then what's the other argument for this? Okay, so you say, well, you know, it's happening, sea levels are rising, you know, hurricanes are happening, so we need to invest billions of dollars into protecting ourselves. Now, if you don't discuss the reasons behind this, then people will say, well, this is just cyclical. So right now we have bad storms, but we're not going to have bad storms in 5 years or 10 years, so why are we investing $10 billion into creating, you know, floodgates in New York Harbor? So that's the problem that Andrew Cuomo's position runs into, that if you basically don't say that a marked and possibly permanent or long-term change is occurring in the climate because of human activity, then people can shrug off this change as something cyclical, and that will prevent you from taking the steps that you need to take to adapt to change, because those steps in something like this isn't high school football, right? This is going to be expensive, and it is going to mean maybe spending money on certain things and not on others. And that's the risk that you run in not having an honest discussion about what is happening, that, you know, it is not cyclical, it is happening, and, you know, you could stop emitting carbon into the atmosphere now all over the world, and it would take hundreds of years for our planet to revert back to the temperatures that we had at the late 19th century before we started putting so much carbon in the air.
The energy and environment reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Neela Banerjee. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Martin Medeski and Wood, Bruce Springsteen, and Rusty Kershaw. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.